Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, coming up in later in today's hour, I'm going to cozy up with some adorable little critters, baby sloths. My second guest I interviewed a couple of weeks ago because of scheduling conflicts. So I'm going to bring that interview to you today for the first time. She is Lucy Cook. She's a British filmmaker, photographer, zoologist. She works a lot with National Geographic. She's the founder of the Sloth Appreciation Society, and she's written the most delightful book and makes fabulous films about these wonderful creatures that I've taken to heart since I learned more about them. They're quite fascinating. And we'll talk to her later in this hour. First, I'm very pleased to welcome somebody who's written an awesome book. The book is about what's being called the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken. It's called The Spine of the Continent. And my guest is Mary Ellen Hannibal. She's a widely acclaimed author, writer, and editor. She focuses on science and culture. She won the National Association of Science Writers Science and Society Award and Stanford's Knight Risser Prize for Western Environmental Journalism for coverage of the Path of the Pronghorn, which I want to talk to her about too. She writes about that in this latest book too. Mary Ellen has written articles for numerous publications, including the New York Times, Esquire, Elle, Scientific America, Outside, the list goes on. She's a former book review and travel editor and is presently chair of the California Book Awards. And again, her latest book is called The Spine of the Continent. It reports on the social, geographical, and scientific effort to save nature along the Rocky Mountains. But it's so much more than that, full of human interest stories and wonderful factoids too. Mary Ellen Hannibal, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
You're joining us from Mexico today.
I am.
Tell us what you're doing down in Mexico.
Well, it's fun. I'm at Rancho La Puerta, which is a fantastic resort. It's kind of like camp for grown-ups with lots of incredible vegetarian food and tons of exercise and relaxation, and it's awesome.
So you're not getting much work done?
I'm not doing a darn thing. I have a knitting project.
There you go. That's lovely. So let's start off with talking a little bit about this project, because as I said, it is touted as the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken. It is a huge project. You traveled the length of the spine of the continent to report on this project. So let's just first of all talk about the spine of the continent and what that is.
Well, the spine of the continent describes the Rocky Mountains all the way from Canada down through Mexico. And there's, of course, many mountain ranges in there, but the Rockies are this gigantic mountain range. And if you look at a really high definition map of North America, you'll see that practically half the continent is mountains. And this is sort of a biotic conveyor belt over which came the first plants and animals that migrated here from over the other side of the earth, and also the first animals and the first people. And there's kind of a complicated back history to how the people and the animals came. But today, here in the Southwest, actually, the Anasazi Indians are descended directly from some of the first Indians that came over that. But the significance of the mountains, as I opened the book, actually, up there in the crown of the continent region, up a little bit below the crown of the continent, which is thus called because there's a river sorting system where rivers go. One river system comes to the Pacific, one to the Atlantic, and one to the Arctic. And it's the only place in the world where three river systems come to a head. And they really start there. They don't come to a head there. But I was up in Canada at the beginning of my book, and we were looking at grizzly bears and wolves up there. And I kept asking the ranger that I was with, you know, there's so much wildlife here. It was kind of intimidating. I felt very much like I was in kind of a primeval world. And he said, well, this is really fabulous habitat for wild animals, and they've been using it ever since they came over. So not only do the Rockies come all the way down the continent, but so is the Continental Divide. So the concept behind the spine of the continent is called connectivity, only connect. Everything is about connection. And it's easier to keep this connection of wildlife along the Rockies than it is in lots of other places, partly because it's hard to build on mountains.
Mm-hmm.
But as the climate is changing, plants and animals are migrating north to cooler temperatures, and that's not 100% what's happening, but a lot of what is happening, and it's been very widely documented. And so as it has been this biotic conveyor belt for plants and animals to come down, so is it a biotic conveyor belt for plants and animals to move upslope and up north. So it's very important as we face all of the challenges of our current times to protect this biotic conveyor belt. And that's really what the spine of the continent is about.
Yeah.
But because it is Canada, the United States, Mexico, and across state jurisdictions, federal jurisdictions, tribal jurisdictions, it's this enormous project to hold hands across our boundaries and create a pathway for these creatures to move.
And because it's so enormous, so many people, and it crosses so many boundaries, as you just said, so many people are involved, from activists to corporations to scientists, nonprofit groups, I'm assuming indigenous tribes too, because we're going across their boundaries.
Yes, it's amazing. You know, Vicki, I started this project when I was researching my previous book, which is called Evidence of Evolution, and that is a book that's based on the specimens of the California Academy of Sciences. So if you can imagine all these scientists that are down in the basement of the academy there with their microscopes and their DNA machines, looking very closely at specimens and then identifying where on the tree of life those specimens go. And they travel all around the world and to these very special spots, many of them of which are here in the States and in Canada and in Mexico. And they bring back samples, sometimes just photographic samples, because they don't take as many pieces of evidence as they used to. And when I was interviewing them, several of these scientists, who were kind of old world type of guys, teared up and cried when I was talking to them. And I was very taken aback. I was shocked, actually, because mm-hmm. they're very kind of like, you know, your old time scientists. This is black and this is white and this is how it, this is what means what. And they're not emotional.
Right, right.
So I was a little freaked out, and I said, wow, you know, what's going on here? And the reason they were so upset, and some of them were also very angry, is that the beautiful, special places that they study life are changing so fast, and the creatures that they study are disappearing. So I was kind of wringing my hands, like, I have to help get their message out. You know, we understand that there's a biodiversity crisis, but we don't really know what that means. So one of the scientists that I interviewed was a woman who's no longer there, Healy Hamilton, and what she does is she uses these massive computer databases and modeling techniques to project where plants and animals will live in the future, but she is hired quite often by groups along the spine of the continent to help determine where are the critical passageways to protect first. So she said, the spine of the continent, and I said, what's that? Because that sounded really positive and really concrete and mm-hmm. something I could understand. And as I looked more and more into it, the story became bigger and bigger, and I could have written a 900-page story. I would have loved to, actually. Because as you say, you know, there were so many amazing people. One of my favorites is Sherry Tippy, who is a hair cutter. It's her day job. She cuts hair in the Aurora Men's County Jailhouse in outside of Denver.
Yes, yeah. I was going to ask you to bring this story up, so I'm glad you did.
Well, it's just, you know, she's just the most wonderful person in the world, one of the most wonderful. There's many other wonderful people, and this is so heartening. For more than 20 years, Sherry Tippy has relocated beaver from where they are not welcome to where they are wanted. And she started out by, she used to be an Arthur Murray dancer, and she was ironing her dressed one night listening to the CBS News, and there was a golf course where a beaver was cutting down the giant trees, and the golf course manager was going to have the beaver exterminated. And she called up and she said, don't kill the beaver, you can just move the beaver. I saw it on National Geographic. And they said, well, you can come and take the beaver if you want. So she did, and she's been doing it ever since. And so it's the story is people who, it is, yes, government efforts, huge places like the Nature Conservancy making, you know, kind of these enormous corporate efforts to help save nature. But maybe even more importantly, Vicki, regular people who are just seeing the right thing to do to help keep nature's connections in place.
Right. Now, let me just go back a second, because you talked about these scientists, these hardened scientists. You know, they are very black, very white, who were moved to tears by this. You know, so many people say, well, extinction is just part of evolution. It's happened, you know, since day one, and it's going to continue to happen. How do you respond to that?
Well, thank you for bringing that up. It's a very important distinction to make. There is what's called a background rate of extinction. And species come and go on this Earth, but typically a species will last about 2 million years before going extinct. Now, to put that in a little bit of perspective, what we call Homo sapiens, what we think of as humans, have only been around for at most 200,000, 300,000 years. So we haven't been here very long compared to 2 million years.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening now is that the rate of extinction is going faster than that background rate of extinction. And in my book, for people who are interested in the science, I do explain exactly what the kind of formula and measurements are for figuring out this rate of extinction. It's very interesting, based on the theory of island biogeography, which in turn was inspired by Charles Darwin's work in the Galapagos. And it all fits together because the island idea is that the smaller and farther away from a mainland an island is, the quicker species will go extinct. Because there's two things that happen. Species live and they go naturally extinct, but newcomers come to a place and replenish the population. And so what's happening now is that we're creating islands out of our natural areas through human development. And we're making these natural places smaller and smaller and farther away from big wild areas. And what the result is, a rate and magnitude of extinction that is very closely reaching pace with the mass extinctions that took out the dinosaurs, for example. And we're at a very critical moment in time where we have the capacity to stop this incursion on how natural extinction goes. But we're not stopping ourselves fast enough. And part of it is we need to protect these large areas of wilderness where we still have them.
Right, and these would be places like Yellowstone National Park.
Yes, but here's an example of the grizzly bear example. So there's about 660 grizzly bears in Yellowstone, and there's about 26,000 up in the Canadian wilderness in the west. And for the grizzly bears in Yellowstone to continue to be a viable population, they have to be connected genetically all the way up to that big population in Canada. It's like a relay race, mm-hmm. where one kind of group of population trades its genes with other populations to keep from inbreeding, because inbreeding depression is one of the things that causes extinction. So we need to connect Yellowstone all the way up to that Canadian wilderness. And a lot of what these ecologists who specialize in corridors or connectivity do is they go and they try to identify, well, where are the real important places where we can connect Yellowstone to the Selkirk Mountains, and then connect the Selkirks and the Bitterroots, and then go make these connections all the way up to Canada. And so it doesn't mean that there's no development in the future. It means we have to be more mindful about where we put the development, identify where are the critical linkages between wild places and protect those.
It makes perfect sense to me. A huge project, as you say. I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to look at how we're starting to do that, how that's starting to come into play.
Great.
We are talking today in this segment with Mary Ellen Hannibal. She's written a fabulous book called The Spine of the Continent, and we are going to be right back with you to talk some more with Mary Ellen Hannibal.
I'm wearing
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Did you know 1 in 3 adults is at risk for kidney disease, and kidney failure is more than 3 times higher in African Americans? If you have high blood pressure or diabetes, you could be the one. Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now you know.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Outside the box, outside the norm, inside your radio. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I am very pleased to be joined in this half hour by Mary Ellen Hannibal, who's down in Mexico taking a well-deserved break right now. So I thank you for being with us while you're on break. Mary Ellen is an author, award-winning writer and editor focused on science and culture. And she's written a really good book called The Spine of the Continent. It is about a huge project. It's described as the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken. Scientists, activists, regular citizens, corporate entities, indigenous tribes, everybody's working together to get this project off the ground. And the key word, you mentioned it earlier a couple of times, Mary Ellen, and I saw it numerous times in the project and the book, is connectivity, connection.
Yes, and connection, I think that probably a scientist would wince at my describing it this way, but I think of it as kind of horizontal and vertical, if you will. So if you think of horizontal connection as creating these pathways across the landscape, that's one way that we really need to preserve connectivity and in some cases, you know, create connectivity that's been broken, you know, restore it. But vertical connectivity I think of as the relationship between species, and that's something that we also need very much to keep nature's workings going. And it's another thing that gets really broken up by human incursion. And the kind of poster story for this kind of vertical connectivity is one of my favorite stories, which is the beaver, to bring back the Sherry Tippy theme. So the United States and Canada both really established themselves, as we know them today, based on the beaver fur trade. And for hundreds of years, beaver were extirpated across the U.S. all the way, you know, until there was basically no beaver left, and also in Canada. So when the beaver were gone, cattle were inserted onto the landscape to create another way of making a living for people to stay west and stay on the land that had been claimed. And cattle, you know, we have a lot of problems with cattle grazing. Cattle can be grazed in a very productive manner, something called mob grazing, or they have a couple of different names for it, rotational grazing. But too often, the cattle just graze, and they destroy the landscape. Part of establishing the cattle was taking all the predators off the landscape. So grizzly bears and wolves and jaguars and mountain lions were all shot and trapped and poisoned until basically there was none left on our landscape. So in Yellowstone, the last wolf was taken off the landscape in the early 1900s, about 1926 was the last wolf at Yellowstone. And then in the 90s, wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone. So what happened between taking the last wolf off and putting them back on is that the landscape degraded. And this has been studied by a lot of different people, and there's a lot of nuance to this, and there's some exceptions, and there's some this, and there's some that. But the general idea is that Yellowstone had been browsed too much by elk and deer, and they don't have cattle are not allowed to roam free on Yellowstone. When the wolves came back, so what happens, and this happens with bad grazing practices as well, is when you don't have a predator on the environment, on the landscape, the ungulate, which is a word for a hoofed animal, but that's an elk, a deer, a cow, eats the greenery at the riverbanks all the way down and just constantly eats until there's nothing. And just the minute there's a little leaf, it eats it. So the greenery can never come back up. Without the greenery, there's no materials for beaver to use to make their beaver dam. When wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, the riparian or river area started to heal. And this, like, how could that be? How could just a handful of wolves really take down enough elk to change that pattern? Well, it turns out that's not what happens. The wolves don't eat that many elk at the end of the day. But when elk wolves are around, they change their behavior. And this was called the ecology of fear. So they, instead of eating everything down to the ground all day long, they take a look over their shoulder approximately every 2 minutes, and they keep moving to keep their eye on whether there's a wolf on the landscape. And just that change in behavior is enough to give the greenery in many places a chance to grow up tall. And it's still browsed, but what's called the leader of the plant can get above browse height, so the plant is no longer just totally destroyed by the browsing.
Yeah.
Then the beaver come back on the landscape, and the beavers change everything. And this is something that just is jaw-dropping for me, just being, you know, I live in California, and I know the West fairly well, and we have such problems with water, and it's going to just get worse as the climate is changing. But if we had beaver on the landscape again as they used to be, we would have a much better water situation, because beaver create this habitat for all sorts of other creatures to come in. First of all, when the greenery is growing healthy, it has deep roots into the soil. So when a flood or fire comes through, it holds onto the earth, and it doesn't just fall into the river and get swept away. Then you have more native fish, you have more birds, you have more insects, you have everything good going on when there are beaver around. So when you take away the top predator, you also, what's called a trophic cascade occurs. Trophic means food, and cascade means fall, and it's really just the top of the food chain impacting all the way down to the bottom. So the wolf at the very top of the food chain has this enormous effect on the health of the greenery at the very bottom. And that's what I mean about this vertical connectivity, so that we need all of the players from top to bottom in the food chain to help nature be resilient and healthy. And that creates better water, cleaner air, and it helps sequester carbon. So there's no way, you know, we do need to reduce our emissions. There's no doubt about that. But we also could sequester a lot more carbon in this soil if we had healthier landscapes. And the way landscapes are kept healthy is by having a lot of species on them.
Isn't it nature just amazing? It takes care of itself if we would just leave it alone.
Yes, and you know what's amazing is so often if you just remove the bad parts, the bad effects, nature will come back pretty quickly. Not in all cases. One of the stories I tell in my book is about the High Lonesome Ranch in Colorado, where for at least 20 years, the owner has been trying to really restore health to the landscape, and it has been so degraded by 100 years of cattle grazing that it's been very difficult to bring it back to health. And so what can happen, too, they brought beaver back. They would love wolves to come back to the landscape, but this is another thing in the West. You have this kind of schizophrenic attitude toward wildlife and nature, where you have a lot of people who love nature and understand that even if we're scared of wolves, we need them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a lot of people who just want to shoot them. And so it's a struggle all through the West politically to keep top predators on the landscape. And, you know, believe me, I do not want to live near wolves. They are not appropriate everywhere. But on these huge, you know, ranches that are hundreds of thousands of acres, they are appropriate. So the High Lonesome Ranch has, you know, they'd love to have predators back, but they don't have them. They brought beaver back, but then a huge, I can't remember whether it was a fire or a flood. I think it was a fire came through, destroyed the habitat, the beavers left. And, you know, you have to then keep bringing beaver back manually, kind of. So it's not like it always springs back, but left with enough time it would. But they want it to come back to health sooner than that.
Right, right. There is a perfect prototype, you say, for this type of, for the spine of the continent, for the what you call a biotic conveyor. It's the path of the pronghorn, which you've written about.
Yes, Vicki, this is the big, it's a big success story. And, you know, when I was writing this book and traveling all down the spine of the continent, looking at conservation issues and asking myself, what is really working? Is it the big nonprofits? Is the Nature Conservancy working? Is the Wildlife Conservation Society working? Or is it the tiny nonprofits that are working? Is it the Center for Biological Diversity, which sues to keep animals on the endangered species list? Is that working? And the answer is, to a certain extent, they're all working. But they're not working well enough to keep pace with the onslaught against nature that is development and human incursion. But the path of the pronghorn describes a single migration of a single herd of antelope in Wyoming. They go through Jackson Hole. And what happened is in the 90s, late 90s, a couple of scientists working for the Wildlife Conservation Society, which is one of my favorite organizations, they noticed that there was a lot of more pronghorn dying getting hit by cars, because this is where fracking was invented. Mm. And this huge natural gas resource was discovered there. And so hundreds and hundreds of wells quickly started being drilled there, and these pronghorn were dying. And because they were, these wildlife biologists knew that these pronghorn were on this ancient migration pattern, most of the ancient migration patterns in the U.S. for pronghorn have been destroyed and are no longer. That does not mean that pronghorn themselves are endangered. They're actually not endangered. They're pretty hardy, and they hearken all the way back to the Pleistocene. They're the second fastest land animal on the earth. There's an African cheetah that's faster than them, but they evolved to be so fast, running, keeping their hindquarters out of the jaws of an American cheetah that has since gone extinct. But the pronghorn, some of them migrate, some of them don't. This particular herd has been using this migration corridor for more than 6,000 years, and it started to be broken up by this fracking. So these scientists went to Niffy Hamilton, who was then the forest supervisor of the Bridger National Teton Forest, and said, "Will you help us protect the path of the pronghorn?" And she said, "Yes, I will." And these people got together, and they got together with local officials, state officials, little nonprofits, and there's artists and writers and photographers who are all involved. And what they did that was really, first of all, you gather this big group of people, everybody under the tent, come on in, let's all do this together. And then they went around all along the path of the pronghorn and had community meetings to tell people, do you know that your town is right on the edge of the path of the pronghorn? Do you know that your property is right on the path of the pronghorn? And people did not know that. And once they knew that, oh my goodness, they wanted to help protect it. So they did. It didn't take that long, really, when all is said and done. And now the path of the pronghorn has the only regulatory protection of any wildlife movement in the United States.
Wow.
But
that's fantastic.
It's fantastic. It's wonderful. And, you know, it's not so easy to necessarily say do exactly the same thing all across the country, because the path of the pronghorn has a few advantages. One is that you can draw it in a line on a map. And it's harder to do that, right, with, like, how do grizzly bears move? How do wolves move? How do Canada lynx move? You can't just draw a line. There's the Yellowstone to Yukon is another wonderful nonprofit that works mostly in the north part of the spine of the continent. And they started more than 20 years ago with a biologist. They radio collared a wolf, and they called her Pluie because they finally got the radio collar on her in the rain, and Pluie means rain in French. And they tracked her, and I'm going to forget whether it's 3,000 or 5,000 miles in not very long a period of time.
Yeah, I can believe it.
And they realized there's just no national park that's big enough for a wolf. We need to, you know, protect these connections.
Right.
So it's hard to say, well, let's protect territory for Pluie, right? Because how are you going to do that? So it's a little harder when you go to other species, but it's the idea, I think, of holding hands across differences and working to really identify where are the animals and plants, where do they mostly need to go? Let's protect those places now.
And, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about your journey, because it is fascinating, and you went down this whole 5,000 miles yourself. Did you go by car? Did you camp? I know sometimes you camped, but did you camp all the time?
I did not camp all the time, and Vicky, I'm not like the biggest outdoors girl in the world.
Well, you live in San Francisco, which is kind of she-she, so, you know.
Well, I will never forget when I was in Utah on this trip with this wonderful woman, Mary O'Brien, who works for the Grand Canyon Trust, and we were camping for 5 days, and it was in October, and it's usually, you know, it's beautiful there in this Fish Lake National Forest. It was really cold. It was freezing every morning, and it started to rain, and I had this tiny little tent. And I remember thinking at about 6 p.m., like, okay, time to go inside somewhere. Time to go in. And looking around and going, well, there is no inside anywhere. There's just that little tent. So, but I really enjoy camping, and especially with other people who are doing something like field biologists are really fun to camp with. And I did, though, you know, and it's a good point that you bring up, because it's a way of thinking about it. When I decide I'm going to go to Canada or I'm going to go to Mexico, I look at my travel route, and I'm going to fly somewhere, I'm going to rent a car, I'm going to drive somewhere, I'm going to look at maps, I'm going to put it on Google. Now I'm going to try, you know, with my smartphone to follow the instructions that the nice lady gives me. But we look at our territory in this way, right? But plants and animals are using the same territory in their own way. And those roadways and even those skyways are often going right across the pathways that the animals and the plants want to take. If you look at a map of the, and I have this map in my book of the interstate highway system.
Right.
You'll see that there's, you know, there's many millions more roads on our landscape than are even on that map. But the major roads you see move, a lot of them move east-west. A lot of animal movement is north-south, so we bifurcate their movement in many cases.
Right.
So when I was, there were a few places, especially up in Canada and the Belly River, where these animals, there were just signs of them all over the place, and their tracks were everywhere. And I just, it was so visceral to think these animals are moving, they're using this landscape all the time, and I never think about them.
Mm. It's just so interesting to see that, you know, insurance companies have actually actualized the cost of hitting a deer and stuff like that, because this is where we lose so many of our animals. And another interesting fact in the book, I mean, it's just full of really interesting stuff. I did not know that beaver teeth never stop growing.
You know, beaver, get me started on beaver. They're just outrageous. This is an amazing animal. So yeah, their teeth keep growing, and if they weren't, so they have to chew to keep them keep them chiseled down.
Again, nature takes care of its own, right?
Well, and here's the thing: like, if you think about beaver, there's a Native American story that beaver created the world. Mm-hmm. That the world was all water, and beaver went down underneath the water and pulled up mud and brought it up and created land for the other creatures to come to. In many cases, I mean, in a way, this is a very, very biologically accurate story about what beaver do, because they do create habitat for other creatures, and they create these incredible engineering feats of these dams. I mean, sometime if you have Google Earth on your computer, type in biggest dam in the world in Canada. There is a beaver dam that you can see on Google Earth.
Oh, wow.
It's more than 2 miles long.
Oh,
and
my
generations
gosh, yeah.
of beaver have contributed to it.
I can just believe it. I walk my dog through some woods every day, and one day suddenly a beaver appeared. I think it was planted there, to be quite honest, because they wanted to cut the trees down. And I noticed that somebody had been chipping away at this tree one day, huge tree. And a couple of days later, I went down and again, you know, more. And then all of a sudden, the tree is obviously in danger of toppling. And then I realized it was a beaver. Somebody told me it was a beaver. And so I picked up a couple of the chips that they had chipped away and took them home to remind myself, you know, hey, one bite at a time, you can accomplish anything. They're amazing.
That's great.
Amazing creatures.
And you know, you see the beaver when they do cut down their trees. How do they know this? But they do it so that the tree falls toward the river. Because they really only use the top part of the tree to build their dam with. And so they bring the wood closer. How do they know to do that? They have the smallest brain relative to body size of any mammal. And yet what they do is very profound.
Right, right. Well, you say in your book, you say we have to view ourselves, or maybe this was on your blog, we have to view ourselves as co-inhabitants on this earth. And it's not going to matter how rich anybody is or how many jobs there are if all these systems collapse. I wrote my book hoping to help people understand what nature is up against and how we can help. And I think you've done a fantastic job. It is entertaining as well as, you know, sharing all the science and the reasons why we need to be concerned about this and be involved with it.
Well, what I love about conservation and this land and water work is that, you know, we hear about global change and weather patterns changing, and it feels like it's coming at us from above. What are we going to do? How are we going to hide? And those are good questions. But the fact is that we can do so much on the earth. We can go out practically anywhere and help restore a river area, help bring it back to health. There's invasive plants to remove. There are just so many restoration projects to be involved with, and it's so much fun to be outside. I mean, it's just, sometimes I just feel ecstatically happy being out in nature, and I think that's all it is being connected.
Yeah, I would 100% endorse that too. That's where I'm happiest, out in nature. And Thomas Lovejoy, Biodiversity Chair, the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment, he calls this book a biography of a big conservation idea. And that's a great way of describing it, I think, because you cover the land, the animals, and the people. It's all about, we're going to go back to that word, connectivity, connection.
Thank you. That's the right word.
Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Mary Ellen.
I guess, you know, I think all the time about how, you know, we're all striving so hard in our individual lives. And so much of the answer is right with us. It is with those co-inhabitants. It's being involved with helping restore nature. It sounds really, I don't know what it sounds like, but just try it. And you will be more fulfilled. And we need all hands on deck.
Absolutely. Mary Ellen, thank you for taking time on your break in Mexico to talk with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ricky.
And can you give us your website? It's
just www.maryellenhannibal.com.
Awesome. And the book, again, is called The Spine of the Continent, the Most Ambitious Wildlife Conservation Project Ever Undertaken. Really well-written, a really good read. I'd highly recommend it. And please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage, we cover the world of animals. This week, March 31st, it's Easter Sunday, and it's Shelter Rescue Sanctuary and Anything That Helps Our Animal Friends Sunday. We'll talk about the birds at Mollywood Avian Sanctuary, and we'll check on the horses at All Breed Equine Rescue. We'll welcome Bothell Feed Center to the Animal World family. Plus, to honor the holiday, we'll talk about living with rabbits and chickens. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Did you know 1 in 3 adults is at risk for kidney disease? If you have high blood pressure or diabetes, you could be the one.
I was looking in the newspaper and saw an article that said if you have symptoms for kidney disease, you should see your doctor. And I really didn't expect anything because I felt healthy. I didn't worry about my borderline high blood pressure. Turns out it was silently inflicting kidney disease. When you know, it's almost too late.
Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now you know.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, let's get silly on April Fool's Day with Seattle artist Carla Sondheim. We'll explore how playfulness and spontaneity can help unleash your creativity. In the art of silliness, creativity for everyone. Tune in Monday at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Ahead of the talk radio curve, naturally. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we're going to shift from the spine of the continent, from the Canadian Rockies through America down to Mexico to Costa Rica with Lucy Cook. She's a British filmmaker, photographer, zoologist. She works a lot with National Geographic. She's the founder of the Sloth Appreciation Society, and she has written a fabulous book about sloths. It's a children's book, but you know what? I learned so much about sloths from that. It was a really cool book. And she's got loads of videos on YouTube about sloths. And her website is slothville.com. I interviewed her a couple of weeks ago because of scheduling conflicts. And we're going to bring that interview to you now. Lucy Cook. And you are a zoologist, as well as photographer, a writer, now author. Tell us how you got interested in this work in the first place, in being a zoologist.
Well, I was always obsessed with animals. I blame David Attenborough. he didn't make such terrific television programs, and I probably would have become a dentist or something. But as it was, I was blown away by the TV shows that he made and I watched as a kid. And they really inspired me, and so I went on to study zoology. I was always fascinated by the natural world. My father's a real country man, and I used to love going for walks as a kid and getting involved with British wildlife. But now I deal with much more exotic animals. But it's kind of in my blood, basically.
And so what was it that attracted you to sloths? And I have to say sloth, don't I? Sloth. And
Would you want to know why it's a sloth and not a sloth?
Go ahead and tell us.
There's a moth that lives on the sloth. There's a moth that lives on the sloth, and it's a sloth moth and not a sloth moose.
There we go. And I should just explain to listeners there that where I come from, we say sloth, but my producer warned me, don't say sloth, no one will understand you. But what attracted you to sloths?
Well, they're one of those animals that's so massively misunderstood. You know, people... the common perception is, I think it was the first person to describe a sloth said that, you know, one more defect would have made their lives impossible. They're generally considered to be somehow sort of, lazy and stupid and just because they're slow. But, I mean, the fact is that their slowness is the genius of them. You know, they are perfectly evolved to survive on a very low-energy diet, and they become nature's couch potatoes as a result. And being fast is overrated. Just because the cheetah's fast doesn't mean he's better than the sloth. But he's not by any means. So that's what I just think it's a fun story to tell, to change people's perceptions, basically.
It is, and you've written this beautiful children's book, which I think is going to change a lot of people's perceptions. And I realized I did not know very much about sloths until I read this book. It's packed full of beautiful photographs of sloths. And they do have this wide-eyed innocence about them that makes them just look so cute and cuddly. Are they as cute and cuddly as they look?
Well, they're adorable creatures. I mean, I think they're just hugely charismatic, and, you know, with their forward-facing eyes and magical smiles, you know, they've got faces that we can really relate to as humans, I think. So, you know, they are absolutely captivating to look at. But, yeah, but like all wild animals, they don't really enjoy being petted and cuddled, and, you know. So, I mean, the sloths at the sanctuary are used to humans, and they, you know, they're genetically programmed to hug, which is one of the kind of really wonderful things about them. But they hug onto the carers, but when they get to adults, they don't really like being petted too much.
Mm. And you just mentioned the sanctuary, so we should let listeners know what that is. It's in Costa Rica. Tell us about the sanctuary.
Yeah, so basically, I'd always been a fan of sloths. I thought they were just fantastic creatures. And then about 3 years ago, I discovered that there was a sanctuary in Costa Rica that was totally devoted to rescuing and rehabilitating injured and orphaned sloths. And I thought to myself, wow, God, what a kind of kooky place, you know, that's just devoted to just this one rather eccentric animal. What kind of a place would that be? It probably would be quite a good story. So I went down and visited, and it, sure enough, it really was a sort of wonderfully eccentric place. It was run by this woman, Judy Arroyo, who's really, really fabulous woman, who's dedicated to rescuing and rehabilitating sloths, and is doing a terrific job there. And it's just a wonderful story. And so I made a documentary about the... Oh, first of all, I posted a video online that I made of sloths at the sanctuary, and it went insanely viral. In a week, it got a million hits, and a huge sort of, you know, got tweeted by Ashton Kutcher and Ricky Gervais and all these famous people, and Kristen Bell, obviously, is a huge fan of the videos that I've made. But and then the Discovery commissioned me to make a documentary, and Simon and Schuster very kindly commissioned me to write a book about it as well. So you know, it is a really wonderful place.
And the outcome of that is that there's now an International Sloth Day on October 20th every year, I read.
Yeah, that's actually organised by a sloth sanctuary in Colombia. That was their idea, but yeah, I think we should all be celebrating International Sloth Day with a mass sleep-in.
I think that's a great idea. It's a great idea. So let's learn a little bit more about sloths. You mentioned they can turn their head. They turn it like 270 degrees, which is more than any other mammal can turn it. They live in trees most of the time. What are some of the most surprising facts about sloths that people probably don't know?
Well, they've got a very extraordinary digestive system. They take a whole month to digest just one leaf. And the reason why is basically the jungle, you know, trees don't really want to be eaten, just like a mouse doesn't want to be eaten by a cat. Trees don't want their leaves beaten. So in the jungles of Central and South America, most places, they're packed them full of, the leaves are packed full of toxins that are very difficult to digest and poisonous to most animals. But the sloth is able to digest those toxins, but it has to do it very, very slowly. And this is the key to their slow-full lifestyle, you see, is that they have to be slow. They have to have a slow metabolism, because otherwise they'd actually poison themselves digesting the toxins too quickly. And then of course they're very low energy as well. So they also, you know, they don't provide them with much energy. So that also adds to their slothfulness.
Yeah, I was going to say nature is amazing how it compensates, you know, for things that are in the environment. Now, does the sloth have natural predators?
It does. Yeah. Its main predator is the harpy eagle, which is an absolutely terrifying-looking creature. It looks like a cartoon eagle. It's one of the world's biggest raptors. It's got a wingspan, I think, of 7 foot, and its talons are the size of a grizzly bear's.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's a really formidable foe. So you think to yourself, nature's couch potato versus this sort of, you know, highly evolved killing machine. How come the sloth has managed to survive? Well, it's done so by being extremely stealthy and disguising itself as a tree. So their fur is its own micro environment that has several different types of algae and all sorts of insects. And they have no natural body odor, so they look and smell just like a tree.
Which is great for if you like hugging trees, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. They're the ultimate tree hugger.
There you go. Now, so if on the ground, because they do live up in the trees, I mean, they're built for living up in the trees. I read that sometimes even they're found dead and they're still holding, you know, hanging from a tree somewhere. But on the ground, they're pretty useless, aren't they? I read they move 15 feet per minute. I thought it was a typo when I first read it.
There are boreal animals, you know, they really are fabulous movers, you know, they're fantastic, you know, as you said, they can turn their head 270 degrees and, you know, they're really incredibly agile. I mean, I think it's like watching ballet, seeing them move. It's really, really incredible. But on the ground, you know, they have 50% less muscle mass than any other mammal, and so on the ground they can't really even hold themselves up, so they look really comical, actually, to be honest. It's not the most dignified of looks, a sloth sort of creeping along the ground, because they're kind of like flat like a pancake, because they haven't got the muscle to hold themselves up, because they're built to hang upside down from a tree.
Right. And when they come into the sanctuary, and when we see them in zoos, you know, you mentioned how slow their metabolic rate was to save them from the poisonous trees, basically. But that doesn't change, does it? They remain the same.
Oh yeah, of course. That's the way they are. Yeah, they don't speed up when they're fed on beans.
Which is what they eat in the sanctuary. What kind of noise do they make? I've never heard a sloth make a noise.
Oh, they make this incredibly... They don't really make a noise, basically. But the babies, like all babies, have a sort of distress call if they get separated from their mother. So you hear the babies at the sanctuary. They make this totally adorable meep sound. It's in some of my videos, actually. You hear them. You hear the sound they make, and it just sort of melts your heart, actually. There's something unbelievably cute about it.
Well, yeah, we'll give out the links after this to the videos, because they are absolutely adorable. I just couldn't stop watching them. So what do you want people to learn about sloths? What do you want them to know?
Well, they're just completely wonderful animals, and that they're not lazy and stupid. They're highly evolved and extremely successful, and we should lavish love upon them, and they and their habitat survives, you know.
Right. And I read they're related to the anteater, which actually surprised me. And
yeah.
A little bit of trivia I read when I was looking on the internet was that they used to have an ancient sloth which lived on the ground and was as big as an elephant.
Yes, I know. Can you believe that? Yeah, basically the sloths, anteaters and armadillos are all related, and they're all part of a group called the Xenathrans, which sounds like they belong in an episode of Star Trek, and they kind of have the looks to sort of warrant that as well. You know, they look
right. Really
kind of space-agey and sort of weird, freaky. I mean, I love them all. They're all fantastically strange animals. And they evolved in isolation when South America was still an island, and it was sort of moving through the Pacific on its way before it crashed into North America and became South America. So they evolved in isolation, and the sloths were once a hugely diverse group, and they were all different types. So there were hundreds of species, including, as you say, the Megarithium, the giant ground sloth, which weighed 2 tons. It looked like a 2-ton hamster with giant claws.
That would be pretty scary. Well, Lucy Cook, I could talk to you for hours. Fascinating work. I know you are also a great defender of frogs, and people can find more about you where?
If they log on to slothville.com, S-O-L-S-L-O-T-H-B-I-L-L-E, or if they look up Slothville on Facebook or Twitter, then they can entertained by my my slothy pictures.
Thank you. And the book is A Little Book of Sloth, and it is fantastic. Lucy Cook, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, that is it for today. I thank you for joining me. I love both of my guests today. I love the work that both of them are doing. Mary Ellen Hannibal with The Spine of the Continent and Lucy Cook with Slothville.com. And just an interesting factoid, you know, I read that sloths don't get fat. They store fat on the pads of their feet. Wouldn't it be great if we had that problem?
We don't get fat, we just get taller.
We get taller, Eric.
I'm going to have a couple extra donuts and put an inch on.
That would be pretty cool. Well, thanks for being with us, everyone. We have to run out of here. You can find me at conversationslive.net. And we'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.